steps with my huge bag of books as to how long I was going to keep you here. And as Peter says, I can always resort to just throwing them at you if things get to that point. I am going to be quoting a lot from a book by a man called Harry Blamires, a student of C.S. Lewis's, who teaches at Winchester. I think he still teaches there. At least he was teaching there. A book called Where Do We Stand? It's a very valuable book, and I was very grateful that Donald Drew sent it to me recently after hearing another lecture on education that I gave last September. But it's important to know in coming to Harry Blamires that, as Donald said in his note about him, that he would not be within what we would normally think of as the evangelical tradition, meaning that he makes a very strong statement that he believes that creation and the fall would come under the category of myth. He always speaks of the myth of creation and the myth of the fall. And also, coming from his Anglo-Catholic direction, background, tradition, whatever, he places great importance on the tradition of the church, the tradition of gathered wisdom over the ages. It's interesting that what Barry referred to yesterday as to the fact that the basic question is really, do we get information from the outside at all? Harry Blamires would very much say yes, but he would have a different basis really for what he accepts to be true. This comes across very strongly in his book. He would have the traditional Roman Catholic basis of the Bible and the collective wisdom, as he would call it, the collective wisdom in the tradition of the church. This is something you have to understand. It'll come across with a few of the quotes, this word collective tradition, in which he places so much confidence. But this isn't at all to weaken the main thrust of what he's saying, which I think is something very valuable for all of us. It's just sort of a little introduction, not central to my lecture, but I felt last time in quoting from some of these things that should be explained before. Now, I'm coming to the lecture with the subject of Education for Common Sense Living, a title I received from somewhere down here over in Switzerland. I don't know who gave it to me exactly. In thinking of this subject, I think we really have to start with the framework of what I attempted to discuss yesterday, and that is some notion of a purpose of life in general. We have to start considering, does life itself count at any age that I find myself to be? And if I haven't answered that question, I really can't start thinking about the whole subject of education at all. To begin with, I have a very good quote from T.S. Eliot, the Blamires quotes, from a series of lectures T.S. Eliot gave in Chicago in 1950, in which he says, in a lecture called The Aims of Education, "But the moment we ask about the purpose of anything, we may be involving ourselves in asking about the purpose of everything. If we define education, we are led to ask, what is man? And if we define the purpose of education, we are committed to the question, what is man for? Every definition of the purpose of education, therefore, implies some concealed or rather implicit philosophy or theology." I think this is very much so. We have to answer these basic questions first. I think that's often the problem in education today, that the basic questions are no longer being considered. And so out of that kind of a framework, it's very hard to have any viable philosophy of education at all. But I think it has to speak to each of us as well. And we have to realize the notions I was trying to deal with in the first lecture about truth and reality as being separate from any concept of ideology. This distinction has to be seen very clearly if I'm going to deal with education. And I have to ask myself, do truth and reality not only matter to me, but have I come to the conclusion that they are valid and rationally attainable? Have I really come to the conclusion, if I call myself a Christian, that this God actually is there, that he actually has spoken, that I can come to the conclusion that what he has spoken is true? And carrying on in this vein, unless I can make a separation, and even theoretically think a separation is possible, between intention and or motivation, that is the subjective perception, unless I can make a separation between that and objective truth, and unless even further than that, the objective truth is what I conclude matters to me personally, rather than the subjective experience, I don't think I have any basis for even thinking of the educational problem. So I think we are back to seeing that what Glucksmann says about hiding behind ideologies rather than being concerned for truth is something very basic here as we come to this whole area of learning, of education. So if I have come in any way to a basic philosophy which is irrational, which is ideological in the sense of wanting to reach a certain goal, but is irrational because it doesn't deal with the whole of reality, if I have based my whole life on something personal and emotive, on a priori assumptions that are not open to question, however fine those assumptions would be, and I would deliberately choose the one of an inerrant scripture to show that it's down to the most basics. If my basic point of view is just an emotive personal reaction which is uncheckable and which is irrational, then I come down to what Blamire's main stand is in this book, and that is that I'm not concerned for truth. I have given up on the notion of truth. I have dispensed with truth as I dispense with rationality, which is what his whole book is about. Now, Blamire's very rightly connects this with the whole idea of authority, not the authority of people, of people's individual personal experiences, which is an authoritarian position rather than a position of true authority. But authority, the authority of truth, is very much connected with the concept of rationality, is very much connected with the proper shift we should all be taking away from the personal and the emotive, which is so common today. It has to be a reality and a truth to which I defer, this whole question of deference that Blamire deals with. Now, I'm going to be quoting some fairly long paragraphs from him as he speaks so very eloquently. If we are seeing the spread of a dispersed, discrete irrationality, it is not because a democratic consensus has come to an end, but because authority has been dislodged. The notion of consensus, which carries overtones of democratic expression of the popular will, is historically subsequent to a phase in which authority was acquiesced in. This may seem to be a quibble, but the intention here is to question whether one ought to characterize our present situation in civil or religious matters as one in which the people at large have changed their minds, opting for diversified nonsense in exchange for reason. If people at large in the nation or in the church are succumbing to nonsense in place of reason, it is not because they have personally altered their opinions, it is because they are submitting to a new authority, or rather anti-authority. It is one of the paradoxes of the situation that anti-authority, which is irrational, is always authoritarian, while true authority, which is rational, is essentially anti-authoritarian. For anti-authority fills the vacuum left by the sucking away of authority. It must necessarily fill it with nonsense and banality. For positive culture and understanding, morality and decency are inseparably bound up with authority and discipline. It would be nonsensical to use the word authority of, say, pop music or Scientology, both of which are drugs numbing the sensitivities and putting the mind to sleep. And then he discusses that in a little more detail. It is not wayward choice, but the lack of choice that lies behind submission to pop music or Scientology. For choice is rooted in intelligent awareness. Lack of choice means lack of freedom. That is why, ultimately, pop stars and cult leaders are more authoritarian in impact and influence than true authority can ever be. They enslave, and true authority never enslaves. It frees. Now, one thing I think to be said right here is that one reason that true authority does not enslave is because it is based on the evidence. It is not slavery, because it is something that opens the whole world to me. It is not blind faith. And on to another little quote of his. Speaking of a non-Christian writer, Charles Fair, But Charles Fair and his like would argue, not that we stand on the confines of two worlds, the Christian and the post-Christian, but that we stand on the confines of two worlds, the rational and the irrational, the rationally consensical and the irrationally nonsensical. And indeed, the apparent coincidence of two such changes or turning points is what most essentially concerns us in this chapter, where an attempt is being made to disentangle specifically Christian worries from the worries of those who, without being Christians, knowingly prefer civilization to barbarism, virtue to vice, decency to moral squalor. This irrationality, which he explains in this chapter, is just as much a concern of the non-Christian thinker who's looking at our culture and who's very disturbed at what is going on. This irrationality which so defines our culture, the giving up of truth, the seeing truth centered in myself and in the subjective, in the personal. Now we'll be dealing with these areas over and over again in this lecture together. And thinking back to my first lecture also, I think what's very much involved here, and Blamire's also speaks to this, is the problem of taking nature as my model. If I take a broken, fallen nature as my model, as we've seen in the Time article so very clearly, we're taking amorality, we're taking a lack of value judgments, we're taking irrationality and lack of distinctiveness as a framework, as a basis for life. And this mentality, as Blamire points out, very much has invaded the church as well, as we see any distinctives of Christianity, as Christianity being something that's true, as being a thing to be very much avoided in most people's way of looking at the situation. And another quote of his: "If the change in the temper of our culture is such that we Christians can enjoy being in the vanguard of social progress in the struggles against material injustice, it is also such that we are tempted to shrink from the mental fight. For the prospect of espousing causes which the established and fashionable intellectual circles of our time tend to regard as obscurantist and fanciful is neither attractive nor invigorating." And on a little farther: "The social gospel focuses attention so sharply on earthly well-being that we naturally find ourselves in alliance with secular trends as we try to put it into practice. And this alliance carries with it the danger of blanketing the basic differentiae of Christian commitment. The Christian social gospel may be desperately needed, and yet not be the overriding need at a time when our culture is under attack from the forces of disintegration and nihilism." He's really pleading very strongly in his book for an awakening to the very thin ice that our culture is standing on. Now, if I take nature indeed as my basis, if I take this lack of distinctiveness as my basis, I have indeed given up on this question of truth mattering. And I think there is the crux of the matter, as Christianity states it. Christianity makes this incredible claim to be true. And is that why we believe it? Because we have come to the conclusion that it is true? Or is it indeed, finally, in our own mentality, only a matter of personal morality, as Blamire will call it? The question is asked because it seems that we have slid unthinkingly into the assumption that our Christianity is largely a private and social, not a professional or intellectual matter, that it is a matter of personal morality and social conscience, of cultivating the moral virtues and helping the needy. This personal, and we know how that ends up, with the whole distinction being made, say, between a person's personal point of view and how he would vote on a question of, say, abortion. There being a division between what one's personal views would be and one's, say, civic responsibility. In other words, this is down to a very real problem. These are not just ideas, again, that are far off, as I think we often dismiss them. I think, as Glucksmann points out, as I referred to yesterday, we are surrounded by a real paganism, a giving up of a concern for truth, a truth that is really true, that doesn't just center in myself and in my own reactions, and a giving up of rationality, and thus a return to the whole bestial, which is what taking nature as my model really is. And Blamire describes it in this way, thinking of language. Now, being in the field of education himself, he's very much concerned in this book about the change that has come in our whole linguistic system as we have changed our concept of truth. Artistic composition and educational development are alike often handled verbally in terms of an upsurge of animal instincts and the snapping of restraints upon restless inner urges, whether physical or emotional. The metaphors implicitly link man with the animal world, evoking imagery of bestial desire let loose in primitive passion and self-assertion. Or artistic composition and educational development are handled verbally in terms of involuntary growth, like that in a garden, the seed nurtured by environment, buds, sprouts, and flowers, into the full-grown glory of a masterpiece, the full-grown glory of human maturity. The metaphors implicitly link man with the vegetable world, evoking imagery of plant life, pushing upwards to the sun, impelled by virtue of its own innate expansiveness and passively receptive to the refreshing environmental nutrition of rain and breeze. And down to what he's saying about this, certainly we are now beset on all sides by psychological, educational, sociological, and historical, not to say popular scientific, commentary on the human scene that relies largely on metaphorical usage, linking man inescapably and finally to the world of nature, confining him within the deterministic system to which evolved animals, vegetables, and mineral deposits belong. Now we come down to this, and we see this, I think, this attitude not only in a very few and select sort of areas of our life today, this lack of being able to distinguish between objective truth and the motivation and the intent, as I said before, in other words, between the subjective appreciation, the sincerity, and the actual truth of what I may be involved in. I think we see this very much in all areas of life, and I was very struck by a review in the English Jewish magazine Commentary from March 1982 on the new film Reds, which I was pleased to see is also here in Australia. Pleased because then what I have to say is talking about something you can go and check out. Now, Richard Grenier is writing on this article, Bolshevism for the 80s, and speaking of this film, to this very same problem and question, is there such a thing as truth apart from just the subjective intention, the motivation, the sincerity, the desire to do good? And to quote from him, I'll quote from the very beginning of the article and then the last paragraph. The Bolsheviks, we all know, oh, I should maybe tell you, maybe some of you don't know what the film is about at all. There was a man called John Reed, an American, who went to Russia and in the 1930s was very involved with the, at the beginning, rather, the Bolshevik Revolution was very involved with Bolshevism and a very idealistic communist, as one could call him. He died of typhoid in Russia. With grave misgivings, as Richard Grenier will state at the end of his article, grave misgivings and fears, really, and uncertainty about what he had gotten himself involved in. And this is a film, Reds, which has been being worked on for the last 10 years, a very complicated situation as it was started being worked on when the world was quite favorable to the left wing and was being produced in an America which no longer is so favorable, with Poland being on our doorstep and so forth. And this article is dealing with this whole problem. But now just to pick out these two things, these two statements. The Bolsheviks, we all know, brought into being a system of government, with Poland only the most recent reminder, that has comparatively few avowed advocates in the West these days. But Reed, boyish, romantic, sublimely ignorant of the theories of the Bolsheviks before their seizure of power, convinced that he was taking the side of the earth's insulted and injured against their malign and only oppressor, capitalism, celebrated the Bolshevik triumph as a millennium. What are we to think of that? The film's answer was most clearly illustrated to me by the words of a well-known fellow film critic, as his face illuminated, we walked together out of one of Red's early screenings. He had loved it. What was so great about the film, he said emotionally, was that it shows that all John Reed's wonderful idealism was still a good thing, no matter what happened afterward. and we get to the end of the article, and then Red's last lines, its last nostalgic old voice, its very last words, "Grand things are ahead, worth living and worth dying for." Jack himself said that. Well, we now know what lay ahead. According to the most recently published estimate, evenly reported by the New York Times' Harrison Salisbury, during the Russian Civil War and from related famine and forceful repressions, 18 million dead. In the Soviet forced collectivization of agriculture and associated imprisonments and executions, 22 million dead. In the Great Soviet Purges of the 1930s, 19 million dead. In Soviet executions after World War II, 9 million dead. And those mostly, as Jerem was speaking the other day, I don't know if he mentioned it here, were people that the West sent back to Russia, this Russian soldiers that the Western European countries sent back to be executed. Other authorities estimate that of Russia's 30 million dead during the war itself, at least half, or 15 million, died at the hands of the Soviet state in massacres of labor camp populations in various ethnic groups during retreats, mass deportations, and continuing deaths in the Gulag. In all, no fewer than 83 million deaths. The fruits of Bolshevism, grand things indeed. One report of John Reed's last days had it that he was, quote, terribly afraid of having made a serious mistake in his interpretation of a historical event for which he would be held accountable before the judgment of history. End of quote from John Reed. But he needn't have worried. In the world of Warren Beatty's Reds, where men are judged by good intentions alone, Jack's as clean as a hound's tooth. In the world where men are judged by good intentions alone, Jack's as clean as a hound's tooth. Now, if we can't make the differentiation between intention, between subjective experience and subjective experience and objective truth, we are left here. We are left in this position. And there is really no way out of that then. Something we must think of very, very seriously. But also we must realize that this comes down to the very survival of the human race. This comes down to life and death issue. Connected to this realization then, or flowing out from it, is the realization that life is what is worthwhile. Not life inside my own head, not my subjective experience only, but life itself, the reality of truth itself. And this should free me from any sort of utilitarianism or pragmatism or political thinking, as I explained Glucksmann would call it, which would say that indeed the end does justify the means, which would be the best way of explaining this pragmatism. And today, very much in connection with having rejected a concept of truth and thus rejecting a concept of life itself actually mattering, we now have a totally mechanical view of reality. Zudo was speaking of this morning, a mechanical view of the human being, of the adult, of myself, or of the child, as only a cog in a machine. This is so well expressed. If my sister Priscilla had come, who was supposed to come to this conference, the walls would be rocking right now to the sound of punk rock, which is what she was going to lecture on, showing the desperation of the young people as they make this music and realizing that they are only a cog in a wheel. No one cares for them. The human being does not matter anymore. They're just part of this large machine. The desperation. And yet if we have this mechanical view of reality, if we've given up on rationality and we've given up on truth, we've given up on life actually mattering, we've jumped into the personal and the motive and the subjective, the intention, the motivation as being the whole, then that's all education can be seen as fitting this person for some job, fitting him for some role in society, because I've given up on any larger notion of truth, which would give me a larger notion of knowledge or of wisdom or of learning or of any other such thing. Rather, education then just becomes job orientation. And I think that's very much what our education has often become today in people's minds. And I have a fairly lengthy quote from Dr. Ruckmacher's book, The Creative Gift, that I saw is on sale out here also. Some little essays that were collected after his death, so they aren't quite in their finished form, as I'm sure he would have polished them. And yet I'm very glad that they were published. He has this very good statement in a section called A Gift of God. Art is not a religion nor an activity relegated to a chosen few nor a mere worldly superfluous affair. Now he's speaking, of course, of the area of art mostly. It certainly very much applies to other areas such as education, such as all of life. He broadens it out to that, we'll see later. None of these views of art does justice to the creativity with which God has endowed man. It is the ability to make something beautiful as well as useful, just as God made the world beautiful and said it is good. Art as such needs no justification. Rather, it demands a response like that of the 24 elders in Revelation who worship God for the very act of creation itself. You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will they were created and have their being. Revelation 4:11. The supreme justification for all creation is that God has willed it to be, and so there is no need to justify, let us say, a tree. A tree is there, and it is meaningful because God made it. Of course, a tree has many functions. Birds sit on its branches, cattle rest in its shadow, and men use its wood for building houses or making fires. What would the world be without trees? Yet even if the tree is indispensable to many ecological cycles and useful to mankind, none of these functions alone, nor even their sum total, can provide the justification for and the meaning of the tree. The tree has meaning simply because God made it. That meaning surpasses all its functions. If we do not see this, we are not far from accepting naturalist evolutionary theories, which are all based on functionalist assumptions. God's creatures require no justification. God has given them their value by including them in the totality of his creation. In the same way, our personal human qualities and activities need no justification. To love is indeed a command of God, but a justification for it is not given. To marry, to praise the Lord, to till the ground, to prepare meals, to talk, to feel, to think, all need no apology within the context of hallowed be thy name, thy will be done. In the same way, art needs no justification. It is meaningful in itself, not only as an evangelistic tool or to serve a practical purpose or to be didactic. Art must be free, free from politics, including church politics, free from traditions of the past, free from mode of the present, free from the judgment of the future, and free from our economic and social needs. Art cannot be turned into a mere function of any of these without losing its indispensable place in human life. After all, Christ died for us in order to restore our humanity and to give meaning back to God's creation. Not only is evangelism Christian, but all of life is Christian, unless we would make Christ very small. But if art needs no justification, it also does not follow that art is to be for art for art's sake. Just as a tree, being more than the totality of its functions, nevertheless has functions, so art is not just there to be art, but is bound by a thousand ties to reality. Nothing is simply autonomous. A tree, a human being, a work of art, all are part of that wonderful fabric which we call reality. No thread can be missing without impoverishing the whole. So even if art has meaning in itself, it can never be on its own. It would wither and die. It is tied in two ways to reality. On the one hand, art deals with reality. It is about fear, hope, joy, love, our surroundings, the things we love or hate. On the other hand, art is used in reality. Music, rhetoric, poetry make up a large part of our social functions and religious activities. And architecture, furniture and textile design, interior decoration, painting and illustration provide the setting for our movements and actions. No matter whether art receives a prominent place or serves in the background, the fascinating truth is that the more it becomes engaged in reality and the more concrete its manifold ties with our daily life, the more we will recognize that it needs no justification. And it's a very, very beautiful statement that Dr. Ruckmacher makes here. And I think this must enter into our bones that we do not need a justification in that sense of how he has just described it. We do not need to move from a mechanical Marxist explanation, in a sense which most of our society has accepted in its large areas of thought, and that is that we must matter economically, we must use our education, all those notions. In other words, we must earn money with it. We need to justify why we spend time reading a book, why we spend time learning something. It's got to serve mankind, or it's a useless, selfish thing. It's got to earn money. We do not have to move from that secular sort of outlook on reality, which sees me as a cog in a machine, to some sort of spiritual explanation and justification, which also just sees me as a cog in a wheel often. I think, no, we can break out of this altogether with what the statement that Dr. Ruckmacher has made, the statement for the fact of understanding creation. Life needs no justification because I was created to live. And that is why I think we need this larger framework, this realization of creation, the realization that life has value and meaning and is important. Very much connected to the field of education. Now, coming to education itself, we usually think of that as schooling, which is a relatively modern concept, of course, as far as this compulsory universal education, and which is very much connected, I believe, with the whole concept of fitting man for society. Very much part of the evolutionary scheme also of progress, of believing in progress. And I have another commentary article by a man called Joseph Adelson speaking to that subject in What Happened to the Schools, which is March 1981 issue. He's speaking of the schools in the United States in the 50s. It was a euphoria that extended to the idea of education itself. Education came to be seen as a sort of universal solvent for the problems of the polity. The utopian tendencies in the American mind were to some large degree invested in the schools, in the notion of perfectibility through learning, very much part of the whole evolutionary scheme of things, of the schools almost proving this or trying to prove this, that all man's ills could be solved through literacy, that all man's ills were due to ignorance, that things were getting better and better, and as the education spread farther and farther across the face of the earth, man's problems would disappear. Of course, there's no evidence of that, and it certainly hasn't turned out that way. As we have more literacy, we don't have less problems, and yet this notion is very much held on to still today. This concept of education as fitting the child into society and making him a useful member of society, a useful citizen, a person who will be able to take up his specific role in society. It's interesting to see that Charlemagne was at least one of the first people who started this idea of compulsory education because of his desire to build a worldwide empire. It was very much connected with this imperialistic sort of view of reality. He needed schooling to fit people for that empire, for their spot in it. Very much opposed, I would say, to the whole concern for wisdom. Rather than that, you do so much see education as training the child, as giving him a certain amount of static knowledge, as it were, that he will need in society. And I think the flip side of that is seeing the spontaneous or the creative, which may seem paradoxical, and yet is the flip side of the same problem. Having given up on the notion of wisdom or of truth, you either just hand somebody something because you want them to know it, because that'll encourage them or force them to do their job, or you give up on the notion of truth by saying, be yourself, be creative, find yourself, because you've given up on the notion of wisdom, of truth, of anything being there to be imparted. And I think both of these things not only end up at the same place, but come from the same problem. And on this whole question of the spontaneous, Bleymeyers has this very pointed paragraph, humorous but also very, very profound in what he is saying, I believe. On all sides, we hear echoes of this voguish pseudo-ethic which solemnly proclaims that a man must become a person, as though he were in danger of turning into a cabbage or a candlestick, that a man must learn to be himself, as though he lived under perpetual threat of being metamorphosed into his mother-in-law, that a man must seek and discover his identity, as though it were buried in the garden or hidden away in the attic, that a man must learn to accept himself for what he is, to find himself, to do his own thing, and so on. These clichés are here treated flippantly, because even on their own terms, as secularist prescriptions and without reference to Christian judgments, they are totally evasive of real thought, utterly bereft of those objectivities in which standards and values, indeed even the concepts of good and evil, are grounded. They exemplify the linguistic and intellectual permissiveness which matches our current moral condition by obliteration of signpost and destination from the pilgrimage of life. They are indeed specimens of tautology, of verbal incest, the currency of non-thought, in whose articulation terms and concepts feed upon each other in a closed circle. Yes, indeed, I would say Blamires is right. We are anti-educationalists if we center everything on the subjective, on the irrational, on the personal, on truth being within myself, on just fulfilling and finding myself. There is then no place for learning. And Blamires applies this directly to the field of learning in this statement. There is a stage of educational development at which perhaps Ian Fleming seems more entertaining than Shakespeare, and Sullivan more tunefully attractive than Bach. The young pupil grows to maturity of taste insofar as he distrusts his own first-hand judgment in these matters, which would prefer Fleming to Shakespeare and Sullivan to Bach, and gives the benefit of the doubt to the traditional literary or musical orthodoxy, patiently, perhaps in some respects arduously, training his understanding. A distinguished statesman has recently observed with apparent approval that the age of deference has gone. If it has, then civilization is doomed. One can go far further. If deference has gone, then civilization has already disappeared. Because precisely we have given up on the whole concept of learning anything. And he goes on with this statement, and those in the religious field as in education who would try to lead others to assume automatic priority of individual assertion over the continuing tradition are not helping the cause of religion or of culture generally. It is important to bring sharp discernment to bear upon such utterances, that is the sort of emotive. Discernment that can penetrate beneath the emotive slants and detect the dangerous recommendation of opinionated individualism over against collective wisdom. And on to this statement. I hope I'm just whetting your appetite to get the book and read it. So in this sphere, the media depend for entertainment on the garnering of conflicting opinions, the provocation of jolly or abrasive interchange, the quick roundup of rival conclusions, and sometimes the final pronouncement of a sort of verdict, often an ambiguous or non-committal one. The fact that decisive and useful conclusions are rarely arrived at does not deter the media, but I would say it's not just the media, it's our whole culture who feels this way about the gathering of information. Does not deter the media from inculcating the notion that the harvesting of random, round-the-table contributions, however disparate or ill-informed, is the proper recipe for getting at the truth. And in some places, even the world of education has been corrupted by the notion that healthy intellectual activity is a matter of ceaseless communal ferment, continuing dialogue, endless chitter-chatter, in the assertive exchange of ill-pondered opinions. Now, there's a difference, I think, as Blamires points out, between wisdom and knowledge and opinionatedness. And I think this is a difference we have to understand. We tend to see all authority as opinionatedness, I think, precisely because we have given up on the concept of the authority of truth. And we have decided that all truth resides, if there is any, in the personal and subjective. Thus, when someone says something, it is opinionated because it's coming out only from himself. It's his point of view. So how dare he say, I should listen to it? This pooled ignorance being of value which, turning to Proverbs 8 as a statement of how the Bible deals with this question of wisdom, we see it deals with it in quite a different way. Rather than pooled ignorance, you have a statement that we do live in a universe with form, as Proverbs 8 points us back to creation, and that there is such a thing as wisdom and truth. It starts out, "Does not wisdom call out?" Already a very different notion. "Does not understanding raise her voice?" And down a little farther, "You who are simple, gain prudence," something to be gained, something to be learned, not just to stay within my own head. "You who are foolish, gain understanding." And down farther, "Choose my instruction instead of silver, knowledge rather than choice gold, for wisdom is more precious than rubies, and nothing you desire can compare with her. I, wisdom, dwell together with prudence. I possess knowledge and discretion. To fear the Lord is to hate evil. I hate pride and arrogance, evil behavior and perverse speech." And down farther, "I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me." And then it goes down and ties it down to the creation, as the whole Bible does. And down to verse 30, "I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind. Now then, my sons, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep my ways. Listen to my instruction and be wise. Do not ignore it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway. For whoever finds me finds life and receives favor from the Lord. But whoever fails to find me harms himself. All who hate me love death." And I think this comes round very much to the position of my lecture yesterday, and that is, there is no other life or reality outside of the truth. So that is the first foundation stone of this. There's something not only worth knowing, but that I must know. And then secondly, you have this strong, strong statement of, "The only ones who find are the ones who watch daily at my doors, waiting at my doorway." And we have dismissed this often into just speaking of spiritual wisdom or some such thing, of finding Christ. But I think it is a much deeper statement that all of Proverbs is making. A statement for truth, a statement for wisdom in all matters. Of all of God's creation mattering, this term of whims this morning, of God being a passionate God, is very much expressed here. So that we must have a realization that man, as we come to education and learning, being centered around man in the sense that it's the individual man who is learning anything, man is important. If I don't understand that, I'm back with the indifference and the boredom and the apathy that I spoke of yesterday. This realization that wisdom matters, that truth matters, then has to be my first point. The second point has to be that I realize that only those who watch daily at the doors will find. This, it seems to me, has to be my first understanding as I stand before a class, as I stand before anybody that I'm attempting to teach. And that is that any learning that goes on is going to be connected with openness and seeking on their part. Very much connected to what I said yesterday of Glucksmann's principle of uncertainty. That is that they realize that they don't know all they need to know, that we all realize that, otherwise no learning can take place. That I realize it's not just a problem of fallenness, but it's inherent in being a human being created in God's image. This awe before knowledge, the desire to know that must be stimulated. And that I realize, it seems to me, as my central responsibility as a teacher, that that is what I should be stimulating. This desire to know, this desire to seek farther, the desire to read, to study, to find out in whatever area I'm supposed to be teaching, rather than giving an A to Z sort of a package. Now, secondly, I'm coming back on some of the things, but in a more orderly way. Secondly, I think that we must realize that all truth and reality isn't shut up within myself, and that fulfilling myself then is not going to be my chief goal. And as a teacher, that seeing that the individuals before me are fulfilled and find themselves and are spontaneous and creative is not my main goal. But rather, I see that as not a problem because it's selfish. I see it as a problem because it is a lie. I am not the center of the universe. all truth and knowledge does not reside within me. And just looking within my own head, I cannot know everything I need to know. A need to learn, a thirst for learning. Well, Myers makes many statements to this. I do hope that quite a few of you will read this book. He makes this statement: for subjectivity and the cult of spontaneity challenge the values of truth, order, and stability in which both Christianity and just civilization have a vested interest. And again, rather our danger is that we shall so internalize our religion as to leave it high and dry on an island of subjectivity over whose shores the waves of real life never lap. And this is so, I think, for any area of knowledge. Rather than having this island of subjectivity over which the waves of real life never lap, should be the opposite. The waves of real life lapping should be what I'm longing to know about. And I should realize that I need this knowledge. As I said above, it is not gratuitous. It is not a luxury. It's not for a selected elite few who enjoy studying and learning. I need knowledge. I need the context of knowing who I am and where I am in history and in reality. And the humanist tradition, which we have turned into a dirty word, but which had a very good Christian basis of seeing man as important and studying Greek and Latin and history and the roots of the language and linguistics so that I would understand myself better, had this basis within a Christian framework. Man matters. Man has been created in God's image, and he is not a little island unto himself. So he cannot just sit there and use language even and know what it means unless he knows something of the basis of his language. This is very enriching, but it's more than enriching. I need that. We have given up, you see, on that notion of there being man, as we discussed yesterday. And so we are left with just fighting. And so I am left on this island of subjectivity, as Blamires describes it. And then in education, I am left with just mathematical and technical education, a reduction of humanism to the mechanisms, as I said above, and that's a reduction of education then also to just technical data, how to do something, seeing the deterministic cause and effect of history, seeing everything in the light of natural law or historical law, seeing it all in the light of an evolutionary view of history or a Marxist dialectical view of history. And it's interesting, this Joseph Adelson speaks to this in his article also. I won't quote from it now, but very much that this has become the key to what education is all about, and that is new methods, one after another, devised to deal with a problem and then discarded, and then a new method. It's always seen as a method being the problem. And then dealing with what he speaks of as the egalitarian, distorted idea of equality. Just to read you that one sentence. In its relation to the federal courts and to the bureaucracies, the schools have had to confront institutions which, like Isaiah Berlin's famous hedgehog, know but a single thing, that thing being a distended and distorted idea of equality. Distended in that it puts equality above all other values, and distorted because it has transformed the original idea of moral equality, the idea of Jefferson and Lincoln, to the idea of numerical equality, that all groups must be represented equally in all statuses. And as he carries it on, it's more than that. You can't grade anymore because of this notion of equality. And you can't in any way make any differences. as he states further down, whether the schools could in fact educate the courts on their narrow idea of equality is unclear. That idea has the fatal attraction of a vulgar belief understood to be advanced. And he's pleading in his article for a return to some other kind of a notion. But the fact is that this is what is rampant in our society today, this egalitarian, amoral, naturalistic model. And so we see society equally as this mechanism, not made up of individuals, but some sort of a mechanism. This is very much coming, at least in Europe, with socialistic ideas coming into the schools of fitting the children for their role, even down to the notion of figuring out how many kinds of different kinds of jobs there will be and just fitting them for that job from kindergarten on. Now, what must our response be? I think our response must be that we fight the whole idea of school being more than school from of school being for more than schooling. This notion, which when I first encountered it, of educating the whole man, which seems like a very delightful notion and seems like a very worthwhile notion, I think is a horrible threat that must be fought. And I must understand the whole concept of molding the child, of forming the child to be this new man in society, of educating him in the sense of fitting his whole personal reaction and responses to his role, is very much out of the Enlightenment, very totalitarian views of state and history that Glucksmann refers to. In this view, the child does not belong. In our view, rather, we must see the child does not belong to society, does not belong to the state, as Udo was speaking this morning, but I would say neither does he belong to the mini-society or the church. We must very much see the basis as being that we are created in the image of God. The individual is valuable. He is not just a person to take up a certain role. And there's a very interesting book on this whole subject called Religion in the Modern State by a Roman Catholic writer called Christopher Dawson. I've given you that on my list of books. Another very worthwhile book to pursue, in which he makes this statement. It was written in the 1930s, which makes it especially interesting in sort of a prophetic way. At the present time, the old forms of individualism are everywhere passing away before the pressure of the modern state. But although this destroys some social injustices, it also creates others and contains the possibility of a new and more serious menace to spiritual freedom. And this tendency is not confined to a single country or to any one particular political or social system. It may, I think, even be argued that communism in Russia, national socialism in Germany, and capitalism and liberal democracy in the Western countries are really three forms of the same thing, and that they are all moving by different but parallel paths to the same goal, which is the mechanization of human life and the complete subordination of the individual to the state and to the economic process. Of course, I do not mean to say that they are all absolutely equivalent and that we have no right to prefer one to another. But I do believe that a Christian cannot regard any of them as a final solution of the problem of civilization or even as a tolerable one. Christianity is bound to protest against any social system which claims the whole of man and sets itself up as the final end of human action. For it asserts that man's essential nature transcends all political and economic forms. His whole book is very, very interesting. That's just from his introduction. Now, I think a strong view of the state of history, of determinism, which coexist with this anti-authority, with this objective view of truth, should not surprise us. Because I think, as Bleymeyers points out, this authoritarianism steps in where the proper notion of authority and truth is abandoned. And I think this is very much exhibited, as I've said, in the whole idea of educating the child, of making him into a good citizen, well-adjusted, making him fit in, which has almost become what education is about, rather than learning. Opposed to this, then, would be the individual not finding truth within himself, not having any cult of the subjective, of the irrational, but rather seeking truth. And realizing that basically this is an individual pursuit that I continue over a lifetime of study has nothing to do with a few years in school. very much something that the Jews have preserved in the Orthodox Jewish communities, this concept of a lifetime of study, which we have very much often abandoned. So I think any curriculum in any educational institution should mainly be concerned with a broadening of horizons, an opening of doors, a provoking of seeking, a presenting what there is to learn, a whetting the appetite, a stimulating a desire to go out and seek and find. Thus, the value of teachers would really be finding people who have this thirst for knowledge themselves. A proper humility. Humility in the sense of all before truth. All before truth, before all there is to know, before all there is to learn. I think a bowing before truth, instead of just propagating one's own point of view, is what Bleymeyer, say, would be calling for in this book. We must understand, yes, there is no neutrality. I never teach from a neutral point of view. That is so. And yet all our points of view finally have to submit before the authority of reality, a reality which God has made, which is not authoritarianism, but which is rather the true authority of reality itself, of truth itself, which is something very different. Bleymeyer points out this difference actually in great detail, but just to give you a little quote of his. The thesis of this chapter would turn the tables on the above usage. Authority is the only thing that can save us from authoritarianism. But in our view, authority attaches essentially to the impersonal, while authoritarianism attaches essentially to the personal, individual will. And then down in another quote, the speaker refuses to pose as a testifier except to the objective thing outside himself. He insists on assuming the role of fellow seeker, listening at your side, not telling you, to the voice of collective tradition. He grants that tradition its authority and is thereby enabled to step personally into the background and to direct eyes and attention to something other and far greater than himself. Not the personal witness. It's interesting that he picks up on this, because this idea of personal witness, of course, is so central in most Christian circles. Now, if I understand these basic points, I think there's very much a third area that needs to be dealt with. The first having been the need to realize that there's only finding if there's seeking. And so the first thing is to make anyone of any age desire to seek. The second thing is realizing I cannot find this within myself. There's something I have to seek outside of myself. There's a whole reality out there to be discovered, to be learned about. And the third thing is, if I realize these two first things, then I need certain skills to pursue this knowledge. I need to learn to read. I need to learn to analyze. I need to learn to think. I need to learn to sharpen my rational faculties, which is why all of French education, based on a good humanist tradition, and I mean that as a compliment and not as a sort of criticism, which now it has become, realizing that I have to learn to think and analyze, sees that as one of the primary goals of education, teaching a child to think. From the very early age, teaching him to analyze something, to be able to see what it is, where it comes from, what it leads to. This sort of intellectual pursuit. And this has very much to do with his learning, a child learning to read, as I say, learning of being presented with a wide scope of reality, whether it's in the area of vocabulary, of not just reading golden books ad infinitum, or whether it's in the area of the kind of vocabulary we use, the sort of subjects we talk about. Very much also, though, in preparing an atmosphere in which this sort of learning is possible. Not chaos, because no concentration is possible for any of us within that sort of an atmosphere. Which means that I don't trust his evolutionary state of maturity that will push him to learn what he needs when he needs it. No, I realize he needs encouragement to seek as I do, whether he's 5, whether he's 10, whatever age the person is. He needs encouragement to seek. He needs encouragement to keep on and to persevere. And he needs very much, as I say, this skill, because I think that's what it is, of analytical thinking, to be developed, to learn to read, not just in the sense of reading the words. Donald Drew claims that, I forget what it is, but some very high percentage, something like 37% of the English population is illiterate. And he says that means they can't actually read something and understand it. That's what illiteracy is. It's no good learning how to read the words. It's this learning to do something with it, learning to come to conclusions, which reading should involve. This should be very much developed at home, should not just be left up to the school, but certainly should be the school's concern. But also in the area of a child's questions, these have to be taken very seriously. If I'm going to be concerned with education, if I say I'm concerned for truth, I have to take his questions seriously, to the extent of giving real answers, or attempting to, or saying I don't know when I don't know. Of also taking him seriously and his questions seriously in the sense that it may take a great amount of time for him to come to some conclusion that I don't put pressure on. Here's the answer. Come on, why don't you believe it? I allow him the time of sifting through, of needing additional information. I take that as a challenge to come up with additional information rather than seeing that as rebellion or seeing that as some sort of fault. In other words, I mustn't hide behind what Glucksmann would call ideological answers or romantic answers or idealistic answers. I must face the questions head on, which is often very hard to do in the sort of world we live in and the sort of issues that come up. And it must always come back to the fact that the person presenting any answer has got to be willing to stand on the fact that the reason they have come to the conclusion they have, not the a priori sort of a situation, but conclusion, the reason they've come to the conclusion they have in that particular area is because of evidence. Be willing to give a reason for what you believe, I think, is very much this statement. There should be evidence that I can point to as to the fact that I have looked through it very carefully myself, and this is why I have come to this conclusion. This exhibits my concern for reality. It exhibits my concern for truth and exhibits the fact that I'm not just trying to fool the child into having my point of view or throwing my personal weight around, but rather I'm really concerned. This standing side by side and being a fellow seeker, I think, is a very good picture. It also means, in thinking of the category of young children at home, that I make very clear distinctions between pretend and real, that I keep the categories clear, that I make a clear distinction between the areas in which I'm sure and those areas in which I'm not sure, the areas in which there are personal reasons for something, the areas where it's a question of truth, that I try to be very above board with the situation, even though that makes it much more complicated for myself. Now, coming into the area of Christian schools, which is the area that people usually ask for and are waiting for, as it were, I would say first, before I give any sort of answer, that I think we have to deal with the practicalities of our situation. The first thing I have to realize is if I'm a parent with a child and I'm asking this question, I probably live in a certain place. I probably have a certain amount of geography around me. I'm not talking theory, which it seems to me is often the way the question is discussed, and so becomes quite irrational in the sense that it has no contact with reality. When you bring it down to practicalities, what you're left with, unless you're going to move, and that may be something you want to consider also, but what you're left with is looking around carefully and seeing which is the best school that fits these sort of criteria. And I think the theory of something else then becomes ideological. And I think the reason for that is that if I'm really concerned for the things we've gotten down through so far together, if I'm concerned that the child be presented with this sort of openness, this spur, this stimulation to think, then I can't simply jump over because of a certain fear. And I think that's often what happens. That somehow, and I can very much understand this, having children of my own, but somehow we start having our decisions ruled by fear rather than by what we really believe to be true. And I think this very much deals with the whole question of literature that was raised. Someone raised this asking for a seminar on this. I think, say, this very much enters in here. And that is that if we really believe there is male and female in the image of God shall I make them, and that this makes up man, for instance, just using that for an example, I should not be afraid to let my child read a Lawrence Durrell. He's on my mind because I've been reading him again recently. Or a John Updike or any of these people, as they're not going to be lured and enticed by what they see. It's quite the other way around. These good writers, the writers who are writing out of the agony of their own moment of history and the agony of what they see around them, are one of our best tools in explaining to the child why God has said that a unique one-man, one-woman relationship is such a beautiful and precious thing. They're the best tool because they show the poverty of the other position, the lie of it. And as I was discussing this up in Sydney, someone was saying, well, what is the cutoff point then? Is there no such thing as pornography? Yes, but you see, pornography is something quite different. Pornography is the dishonest person who, for money or some other reason, is exploiting sex. That has nothing to do with an honest writer like a Lawrence Durrell, like a John Updike, like a Fowles, who are out of the agony of their own situation trying to cry out, what is maleness? What is femaleness? How can we have a relationship in the midst of the broken world we're living in? And as they struggle with their own situation in such eloquent ways, it is no enticement. I think the enticement is the maybe James Bond sort of thing, the enticement of the soap operas. The enticement of those things is precisely that they present a lie. They present a lie. And I certainly, in being very interested in literature, both French and English, and reading a great amount, feel no fear in letting my children read these books, as I feel it is their best illustration in a much more eloquent way than I could ever put across, that there is no other way to live that is fulfilling and that really fits who we are as human beings created in the image of God. It's far rather, I think, the child who's been protected and who sees this glitter of the world with a capital W, all these wonderful, fun things that everybody else can do but I can't do because I'm a Christian, that tends to be enticed away. Anybody who is agonized through a school friend who's being taken away from his parents because they're alcoholics, as one of our children had last year, who is agonized through a child being torn apart because his parents are going through a divorce. In the midst of the reality of life and the reality of one's reading is presented with all this, has a great thankfulness, I think, for what the Bible gives us as an answer, as precepts by which we can live, by which we can understand ourselves. I think this fear then, and I have just digressed to use that as an example since somebody had asked about the whole thing of literature, just I realize it's not a full answer, but to touch on it, I think it's the fear, in a sense, of being afraid that the child in being presented with a full scope of reality will just wither. That the truth, the answers of truth will not be there to sustain him, that this fear often is what dominates and guides people's decisions. A very unhappy thing. Because for a child who is usually very perceptive and will realize that at some point in his upbringing, to realize that the main decisions in his about him are made in a spirit of fear, this child truly, I think, in a sense, is in a dangerous position. He wonders what there is to be afraid of. How fragile is the Christian faith? How fragile is the thing we call truth? And so forth and so on. So I would start with the practical, and that is, as parents, we should look around and see what is the best school. There may not be very many choices. We may have to move. We may have to do something drastic. Keep the child at home and teach them with a correspondence course. I don't know. There may have to be drastic solutions. And yet, I think we have to deal with the practicalities, first of all, of realizing we find the best that there is, rather than ever thinking of it as just theoretically perfect, which there isn't such a situation anyway. And so I think that with my own child, I must have the same open view that I presented in the beginning of the lecture. I must not feel the need to indoctrinate him. That's what I'm really, really asking for. And that when I realize that temptation within myself, which I think I should see it as a temptation, indoctrination being that I somehow twist a psychological or emotional arm, that I don't allow him the freedom and respect that God gives us of choosing away from himself. This sort of thing. That's what I mean by indoctrination. That when I feel this temptation, whether it's for the child's good or not, that I realize it is a temptation because of the fact that I would say it applies in this situation also, that the end does not justify the means. Manipulation of the human being, lack of respect for the human being is always manipulation, is always lack of respect, no matter what goal it's meant to achieve. If we doubt this, you see, we open the door to it precisely all the indoctrination that has gone on, all of it has gone on in the goal of improving the human being and improving and helping the human being. It's almost never out of poor motivation. That's why I started with the need to differentiate between motivation and intention and truth. I must exhibit a confidence, I think, to my child, whether it's my personal child or whether it's in teaching Sunday school or whether it's a school teacher who is being asked about his views or is teaching in a Christian school. I must exhibit a confidence of the fact that this is the only truth there is. There isn't a Christian truth and a non-Christian truth. There isn't a Christian view of marriage and a non-Christian view of marriage. There's a realistic view of the man-woman relationship and an unrealistic one in various shades, less and less realistic or more and more. But there is no such thing as a Christian view versus a non-Christian view. And I think very much this desire to seek has to be very much spoken to, especially into the Christian situation, where often you have this awful, terrible apathy because the child doesn't realize the questions, because he doesn't realize the agony of the human condition, precisely because he's been so protected. He needs to realize the questions so that he can begin to seek, so that he can find. Something of this has to come through. Now, the last reason, the last point on education that I would like to make a statement for is the realization that we should all come to over and over again of how much truth, rather the truth of realizing how much ideas shape reality. There is a reality out there, but people's ideas have changed reality, continue to change reality, as do mine, as do yours. And as we saw yesterday in Aristotle's definition of evil is changing the very form and matter, the very stuff of existence, this aspect is not to be ignored, that I'm coming back to something I touched on, but that ideas are not just icing on the cake, are not just something to be dabbled in as a luxury if I have any extra time. This is what is shaping my reality, is shaping my children's reality. They must understand the importance of ideas. There is a reality there, but part of the reality that's there is that I've been made in God's image, that I'm a creative being, so my ideas change things. So it's very important to understand what is being put forward, not just for a few, again, who see it as a sort of a game, but rather because it is a life and death issue again. As I just discussed, reading that terrible statement of about Reds. Now, precisely because there is a real world there, and because I can't live in any other reality, when I create an illusion, I destroy the reality that's here in the sense of damaging it, because I clash with this real world. And I have to demonstrate that I really believe that, if I come to the conclusion that that is true, by really exhibiting this in my own daily life. What sort of a model do I give my children as to how I use my free time, as to how I use my leisure, as to how many new things I continue pursuing and learning, as to how open I am, but also in the sense of how concerned I am about the ideas, how much they're trained to discuss around the supper table, ideas, concepts. I'm really appalled always in looking at Sunday school material, how so little is taught conceptually, so few ideas. It's as though it did not matter You teach stories, you teach isolated facts, you don't have to teach concepts and ideas. We have to grapple with this area. We have to come to some conclusion, and then we have to be consistent, it seems to me, in the way we raise our children or in the way we teach, the way we live out our lives, indeed, in the fullest sense of living out our lives. I would just give a couple of quotes as I come to a close from Blamires. Christianity commits us to the concept of an ordered, meaningful, purposeful world. By virtue of the doctrine of creation, Christianity has a vested interest in those notions of order and objectivity, meaning and purpose, which are currently at a discount in the kind of fashionable thinking I have exemplified. The approval noises and disapproval noises of current relativism and subjectivism are antithetical to the Christian notion of an ordered universe created by God to serve his good purposes. They are congruous with the notion of a cosmic flux within which our human careers are so many limpid fluidities, attaining casual significance only insofar as the topography of riverbed and bank or the contact of fish and weed brings about in us a ripple, a froth, or a bubble, here one moment and gone the next. And on a little further, it will not do to judge anything at all by recourse to relativist and subjectivist whims and feelings. Put crudely, it will not do to be forever thinking in terms of, is this really me, or does this grab me, or do I dig it, or whatever is the latest jargon in the life is froth and I'm just a bubble game. And on again. The voice that approves the new fashion because it does something to me can very soon be approving a Beethoven symphony because it does something to me. Soon after that, the voice can be approving a magnificent cathedral, a beautiful ceremony, a great book, a heroic deed, a mighty communal venture on the same grounds. This should make the absurdity, the vanity, the enormity of the subjective evaluation apparent to all. In short, our thinking in trivial matters is being lightheartedly subjectivized, and this in itself might seem unworthy of grave discussion. But the growing scope of the habit of subjective evaluation is a threat to those fundamental principles of objectivity that are built into the doctrine of a meaningful universe purposely made by God. If a great work of art, a heroic deed, or a mighty communal venture must be valued for what they are and not for how they tickle the fancy or the feelings of onlookers, then in proportionate degree, the lesser delights of life must be valued similarly. He's speaking for a habit which I build up. And I think that's where what I meant earlier by saying consistency. This is a habit I build up of the objective truth mattering or of everything being always reduced to the fact that I like it. I like it. And that's what we reduce most things, especially in the area of art and aesthetics and, well, so much of what human endeavor is all about, to the subjective level. I like it, I don't like it. We must begin training ourselves, I think, as Blamire says, to something different if we believe in truth. We must move away from the inconsistency of our own position. Now, I think we must realize in conclusion that there are no shortcuts. There are no methods. There is no way of achieving a perfect education. I've had lots of different brochures and things given to me since I've given these two lectures out in Perth and in Sydney. And what amazes me in all of them, it's always sort of the way to do it, the method. This should immediately put us on our guard. There is no method. There is no shortcut because we're dealing with a question of seeking truth and wisdom. And that takes years. It takes years of indeed, as Blamire says, waiting at the doorway. It depends on an active attitude of not letting my circumstances, environment, family, church, history, state, control and dominate without questioning. It means that I have an active attitude, that I sift through, that I come to conclusions, that I take my time, that I'm not hurried by peer pressure, whether that is in or out of the church, to coming to a fast conclusion, to coming to a conclusion I'm not sure of. It means that I really take up my responsibility of having a proper dominion over the world, as Adam was commanded to have. And that for others, I should not be encouraging them to give up their moral and intellectual responsibility. So I should not resort to authoritarianism of the don't doubt, don't question so much, don't think so much sort of variety. And this is very much so, I think, in dealing with children. Very much so. So many people have been wounded in their backgrounds by this attitude. I mustn't be trapped. I must fight and see it as a real temptation, the whole trap of new ideologies that present themselves as the answer and which blind me to reality, but which also are seen as goals to achieve, and I steamroll over everything else to get to that goal. And thus, ultimately, I destroy man, even if it's in the name of saving him, of the name of building a better society, a new man. And to counteract this prevalent tendency in myself, in yourself, in ourselves, I think we need all the tools at our disposal, all the tools to make us sharp, to make us active, to make us look around. All the leaning away from what Bleymeyers would call the numbing drugs. We need to face the world. We need to face the culture, the ideas, and see them for what they are. Yes, it is a lifetime task. And so I would really make a statement that I would really hope we would all be concerned for education in its fullest definition, not to just to keep people within something narrow of our definition of what we want them to fit into, which is exactly the socialist definition of education, as I've said, but rather to be truly concerned for knowledge and learning, for a pursuit of truth, not to just be caught within some new ideology, not to be caught within making a chasm between the spiritual and the secular, but rather to understand man is created in God's image, and that thus I must have a love for personality and for all that personality produces, rather than a cult of impersonal nature. This, it seems to me, is what education should be about personality rather than mechanics, about using my thought processes and about valuing the wisdom others have arrived at through their thought processes, and thus truly honoring the God in whose image I've been made, and honoring and respecting that world which God holds so dear. I must demonstrate that. I must demonstrate that in my whole outlook toward life, in my whole outlook towards rearing children, towards education. So I'm making perhaps an unusual statement, but I hope one that we will really take into account and see that so often we have had very good goals in mind, as Wim pointed out in his beginning lecture. That is not the problem. The problem is not how good the goal is. The problem is not either how good the intention is, as in the case of John Reed. The whole important factor to be considered is, how true is it? How true to the fullness of truth is it? Not just how much is it helping me achieve a goal, or a goal in the sense of an external goal, or an internal goal in the sense of the subjective, spontaneous fulfilling of myself. Now, I don't know if we have any time for discussion now, or if we should just leave it for this evening for anyone who wants to discuss it. I am going to have a discussion this evening on this subject, so we could just leave it for then for anyone who wants to pursue it. You should do that.